Shalom liyudim, shalom abedei noach, shalom liguyim. It's the evening of the sixth day, Kaf Zayin be'elul parshas nitzavim, tashinayim vav, the evening of the fifth day, Thursday, 29 September 2016, webcasting from the hills of Judea. Well, there was only one story today in all the media in Israel, the passing of Shimon Peres. In Yediot, in Israel Hayom, I only see Haaretz twice a week, but I imagine it was the same, one eulogy after another. The best one, leastwise, the best headline, came from Michael Freund in Jerusalem Post. The headline was, quote, "Choosing which Shimon Peres to remember." Indeed, Peres 1.0 was a security hawk, an acolyte of David Ben-Gurion that he served in the 1950s. It's long forgotten that following the virtually miraculous Six-Day War, which the atheists of the Israeli left could not see, they nonetheless looked upon Judea and Samaria with clear eyes as far more of the heart of the land of Israel, biblically speaking, of course, than the coastal plain, which was the heart of Israel till 67, and still is in many ways. And in any case, they experienced no pangs of guilt for driving the Arab Legion, the Jordanian army, out and taking over. No guilt! And like other nations victorious in war, felt no obligation to give back what they took. On the contrary, the reigning Israeli left at the time adopted the Alon plan that called for annexing a serious portion of the land taken, mostly for security reasons, but not all. This is long forgotten. They were also in tune with the heritage of the Jewish people. Even Moshe Dayan supported the idea of keeping Hebron for the cave of the patriarchs, the Machpelah. None of the ruling political elite in Shimon Peres' camp thought Israel had to return all of it. Also, the strategic necessity of maintaining Israel's presence along the Jordan River. Over time, too, radar installations would be erected on the ridge lines of Judea and Samaria to see, as never before, into Arab skies east of Israel. And that those of you who have read my book know that not for 3 years after the Six-Day War was the topic of the Palestinians raised in a United Nations resolution. So post-war in 1967, nobody in Shimon Peres' party was pleading for Israel to hand over Judea and Samaria to the ancient nation of Palestinians. Many Israelis thought, after the astounding victory, as Moshe Dayan thought, he was the reigning defense minister, and he predicted that the phone would soon ring and on the other end would be the Arab states saying, "Oh, okay, fair and square, you won. So just return what you took and we will love you and make peace. Land for peace." But things did not work out that way. And if memory serves, although my research turned up nothing to confirm this, in late 1968, a year and a half after the war, when no telephone had ever rung, Golda Meir said, "We are not going to wait for you forever." And following the terror atrocities that ramped up in 1968 and 1969 and 70 with the War of Attrition, and then the 72 Munich massacres at the Olympics and 73's Yom Kippur War and 74's horror at Maalot, nearly two dozen children murdered, many Israelis were coming to the conclusion that the phone had not rung and will not ring. So let's start thinking about keeping Judea and Samaria. Right after the war, the Labor government allowed the old Gush Etzion settlements, destroyed and the people massacred in 1948, to rebuild, thanks to pressure from Rabbi Hanan Porat of blessed memory. And the government commissioned the building of the new community of Kiryat Alba next to Hebron. But other than that, nothing after seven bloody years in the way of building was launched. Hence, the national religious movement rose and as never before and pressed for more new Jewish communities. And one of their supporters was Defense Minister Shimon Peres. The first of the settlements was Ofra. And there's a famous photograph of a smiling Shimon Peres planting a tree, the first tree in classical Zionist chalutzim fashion. Ofra was the first Jewish community between Afula and Jerusalem, and today it is home to more than 3,000 Jews. Then came like a sit-in in Sabastia that turned into another new Jewish community, and Shimon Peres, the security hawk, if not religiously motivated, was on that project too. In 1976, Shimon Peres became godfather to Ariel, today home to 20,000 people. So much for Shimon Peres 1.0. Shimon Peres 2.0 emerged in my purview with the Scud War of 1991, when Tel Aviv was showered with more than 36 missiles, and every evening tens of thousands, maybe scores of thousands of people were jumping into their cars and driving out of the city in rivers of vehicles, carrying truly terrified people. One Scud landed about 50 meters from the apartment of my friends, and the impact scared the hell out of them, and they knew that if it had landed on their three-story apartment house, they and their two little boys would not have survived. Saddam Hussein's satanic missile teams kept trying to hit downtown Tel Aviv, and by one account, they wanted to hit the Kiryah, as we call it, which is Israel's Pentagon, located in Tel Aviv. They kept missing, and missiles fell short into Ramat Gan, populated, ironically, by Iraqi Jews who had fled that country years before. And for sure, not far from my friend's apartment, was the apartment lived in by Shimon and Sonia Peres. And there's no reason to think that their apartment was any more fortified against missiles than that of my friend's, so it's fair Peres was scared to death, too. And that, I think, saw the birth in this hysterical man's personality of Shimon Peres 2.0. I think he was seriously traumatized. For sure, also, he did not fight in 1948 when all of his friends were in Haganah. He was at the time head of the youth division of the labor movement and would tell historians he was asked not to fight by the leaders who wanted him for diplomatic duties, but I wonder. I once saw a photograph of him and others in the leadership in the 1950s welcoming back from a counter-terror operation a team led by Ariel Sharon, again fighting the Fedayeen. And in the picture, there was a smiling Ariel Sharon and other fighters. It was at night, and the illumination of the flash from the camera's bulb lit things up, and the photographer caught them, I think, unawares, or so it appears, but Peres stood out among them for the fear in his eyes. In any case, it's known, historians will note, that following the Scud War, Shimon Peres believed that holding territory no longer meant anything. If the enemy can fire missiles at us from hundreds of miles away, what matter our presence on the hills of Judea and Samaria? For him, it was a new world, and the only way to survive was to deprive the enemy of his excuse for firing missiles, which he told himself was our presence in Judea and Samaria. I think he had some kind of nervous breakdown. Chronologically, this explanation fits because the Scud War ended on the last day in February of 1991, and then 15 months later, Rabin became prime minister for the second time, Peres his foreign minister, and by December of 1992, the famous scientist of politics, Dr. Balin, had been given the go-ahead by his mentor Peres to send Israeli academics to meet illegally with the PLO in Oslo and start the ball rolling toward the famous Oslo abomination on the White House lawn of September 13th, 1993. And then the rest is history. Because it is unseemly to say bad things about the deceased so soon after his passing, I mentioned some of the good he was a party to. And at this point, I'll just repeat, and the rest is history, following the handshake on the lawn, the hundreds and thousands of Jews maimed, mutilated, and crippled for life. I'll also just recall the moment in 1998 when Shimon was photographed kissing Yasser Arafat on the cheek. That poisonous lizard of a man, like Ishmael, that Per Adam, that wild ass of a man, Arafat was a Tsefa Adam, in my language, a viper of a man. So I do not mourn the passing of Shimon ben Yitzhak. He was blessed by Hashem with a long life and a healthy one until just recently. We should all be so healthy. Surely a gift from Hashem to him for the good he did. But I can talk about his admirers, and I will, after some music.
מה הצליח לקרום לך לעצור ושוב ללכת? האם שמעת את השיר ששרה הציפור לך? האם שמרת בחיסך את העלה שנחל ראשך? האם כבר שרת שיר היום? האם מצאת שביל היום? האם הקשבת לחלום? האם ברחת לשלום? אדם בודד הולך מולך, לעולם לא תדע מה עובר לו בנשמה. מה דיברת היום? למי הקשבת היום? האם פינית מקום או זמן לשפוך לבך כמים בן אדם? לאן מיהרת היום? בספסל עצרת לנשום? כן, כל אדם צריך מדי פעם לעצור ולהביט לשמיים. שמעת את השיר ששרה הציפור לך? האם שמרת בחיסך את העלה שנחל ראשך? האם כבר שרת שיר היום? האם מצאת שביל היום? האם הקשבת לחלום? האם ברחת לשלום? אדם בודד הולך מולך, לעולם לא תדע מה עובר לו בנשמה. אספת היום, את מה השלחת במקום? שנים ניסית לבלום, לגזום, לפרום, אך לא באמת העזת לומר שלום. ענה לי לפני שיהיה מאוחר מדי, מלא לי בי כי לא אומר לך די, לא אומר לך די. לשביל שגילית פתאום ואספת מאבני המקום, ביקשו העיניים את עצמם לצום, להביט פנימה בסולם שהופיע בחלום.
I think the news said this evening that 90 dignitaries will be here tomorrow for the funeral, including the Muslim Brotherhood agent in the Oval Office and legions of parasites who so loved and admired him. The Pope's coming, and King Billy the Kinky, and Lady Macbeth Clinton, and who knows who else. Because he was, Peres was, ultimately the secular antagonist of Israel's religious Jews in the eyes of the world. When he lost the elections for prime minister in 1996 to Netanyahu, he told a Haaretz journalist, not that he lost, but we lost. And when asked, who is we, he answered, the Israelis. But if so, the Haaretz journalist asked, who did win? And Shimon said, the Jews. And in my book, I also report that, ironically, a veteran Haaretz journalist once reported about Rabin as chief of staff, who used to make jokes about the political leadership, whom he called the Jews, because many still spoke Hebrew with a Yiddish accent and even fondly remembered life in the Yiddish diaspora. And for standing for this variety of Israeli, what the left called the new Jew, Peres has been loved abroad for his willingness to hand Judea and Samaria back to the murderers in the Arab camp, because the desire to stay is associated with religious Jews, and every enlightened modern person knows that religion is superstition. Old wives' tales, myths, legends, and folklore that no enlightened person takes seriously. And this is why this who's who of VIPs are coming tomorrow. Shimon, like Alan Dershowitz, believed peace was more important than Jewish rights to live in Judea and Samaria. Sure, such post-religious centrist Jews might say that more important than Jewish rights is peace with the poor, poor Palestinians who have rights to this land, you know, just like the Jews. And never mind, the Jews' Bible says nothing like that. There's no mention of any other nation with sovereign ownership rights to this tiny country. They are hooted at, the Jews, for being greedy, for not wanting to share Palestine with the Palestinians, who have as much right to a state here as the Jews, so the enlightened believe. This is the thinking of contemporary anti-Jews, from big-time haters to spineless narcissists like LTF Little Tommy Friedman, or Martin Nindick and Danny Kurtzer. This is why tomorrow the main road in this tiny little state from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem will periodically be shut down to allow the arrival of the dignitaries at Ben-Gurion Airport, allow them to rise to the holy city. There's likely to be a colossal mess because of this, but no matter. All the who's who of the world who loved Shimon for his support of the victims of Zionism want to exercise their support for this, arguably, the most politically correct opinion on the planet. For sure, the lion's share of those in attendance tomorrow will be two-state solution devotees, meaning they will be opponents of the Bible, especially those of Jewish extraction. I mean, it's well known that the first words spoken by the creator of the universe to the first Jew ever, Avraham, is, "Get thee to a country I will show you." And at the end of the five books, among the last verses, we read of Avraham's great-grandson's great-grandson, Moshe, just before his passing from this life, standing on the east bank of the Jordan River, looking over at the land promised to his great-grandfather's great-grandfather 500 years earlier. That's how intimately connected is Jewish belief and the promise of this land. In this sense, Judaism is, in a nutshell, all about taking possession of this land to live in it by the 613 commandments dictated by God that are found in the five books of his scribe, Moshe. And those who think this land also belongs to the ancient ones is an opponent of the five books and all that came from them. And this includes Christians and Muslims who think it's wrong for the Jews to have exclusive rule over this land. It's the Holy Land, holy to the three great monotheistic religions, and the Jews have no right to a monopoly ownership. Greedy Jews think that way. Greedy, greedy Jews. Along came Christendom and declared that, in fact, they, well, that is, the original Roman Catholic Church, are the real Jews. And along came Islam and said the Jews had not only killed Jesus, who was a prophet, if not Allah himself, they rewrote their five books and stole the roll of the son that Ibrahim tied up. Muslims, just read the Hamas covenant, are the real bearers of Ibrahim's religion. They are God's favorite people. They too believe that they are more or less the real Jews. Then along came the phantom Palestinians in our time who claimed to be the real owners of Palestine, too, that the Jews stole from them. The Jews had their Holocaust that gave them the right to claim on the world's conscience recognition of their right to a state in Palestine, and so, too, the Palestinians suffered their Holocaust, the Nakba, when the Jews acted like Nazis and treated Palestinians like Jews. And now we read of a senior activist this week in the Labour Party in the UK, one Jackie Walker, who's close to party leader Jeremy Corbyn, who says the National Day honoring the victims of the Holocaust should not be solely about Jews. She asked, wouldn't it be wonderful if the Holocaust Remembrance Day was open to all people who experienced Holocaust, close quote. Whatever that means. Not that this should surprise any of us. Every January 25, the UN's Remembrance Day for the Holocaust, yours truly takes note of how speeches by VIPs include lots of groups beside the Jews. There are even anti-Jew Jews here in Israel who think it's greedy of us to hog piggishly the Holocaust. When the Jordanians ruled here, no one complained that they were hogging the holy city. Israel today, by contrast, is accused of that. Jerusalem is holy to the three great monotheistic faiths, and it's wrong for Israel to have exclusive control. In a word, I love behavior like this. I like to listen to a Jackie Walker who flaunts her ignorance and stupidity, but above all, her irrational hostility to Jews, because our presence, our religion, our immortality bothers people like her, big time. And that is why tomorrow the beautiful people will be here to honor Peres 2.0, leader of the camp in Israel, pining to hand over the heart of the Promised Land to the victims of Zionism.
סגרה עליי דרכי ואם אמת ובנפשי על כל הרגעים תודה אני שומע מנגינה היא מתבהרת את מתוך העננה שקט הכובל כאילו מאמינה בינתיים עד שבאת לתוך חיי לא היה לך לאן לברוח את הטעויות שלי לעולם לא ייתנו לך לשכוח עד שתשוב אליי המנגינה
Listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. Yeah, this chronic envy of the sons of Enosh, humanity, of the Jews, of our religious ideas and beliefs and claims, is part of the chronic war against this people whose very immortal existence and achievements discomforts man, because it makes him think, phew, maybe they're right, maybe there is a God, who in the Garden of Eden, as soon as he created Adam and Eve, saw to it that their first download of information was about being a human being, was that there's good and there's evil, and man should choose good over evil. But man has that problem. Evil is commonly unbridled appetite for pleasure in the short term with no regard for the long. The Jews have been mocked and abused and horribly treated throughout history, and it continues to this very day, and even among the Jews themselves. We had the latest episode of this Jewish anti-Judaism just a week ago this evening, when during the Israeli imitation of the Oscar Awards, the Ophir Awards took place, and Ministress of Culture Miri Regev at a certain point stormed out when some performer was reading lines from an infamous poem written by a famous Arab hater of Israel, born here, calling for the horrific destruction of Israel. Now, she stormed out at that point, but then came back and berated the organizers for allowing this, with some of the audience applauding her remarks, with others booing, making catcalls against her. At one point, some attention-craving actor known for his leftist views jumped on the stage as if to attack her, but had to and was restrained by others. She was protesting the fact that the Israeli government, like governments elsewhere, subsidizes the arts and entertainment. She said there's no place for featuring the hateful words of this Arab poet calling for the destruction of Israel in such an evening. There were boos from devotees of poetic license and freedom of speech, and against her presumed desire to limit their free speech and creativity, which in practice means respecting the right of people to call for the destruction of Israel, and to do so with financial support from the government of Israel. Yeah, this is a famous poem by Mahmoud Darwish, written, I think, in the First Intifada, late 80s. That was the latest example of mankind sneering and snarling at the existence of the Jewish nation, and I find it somewhere between fascinating and bizarre, the blindness of such people as Mahmoud Abbas, Darwish, and their own inconsistent irrationality. Like my late Professor Edward Said, who railed against Israel for creating an exclusively Jewish state, in which all non-Jews would, of course, feel less than equal. At the same time, he and they called for a Palestinian state that would be completely Jew-free. When Jews want their own state, that's racism. When the Palestinians do, that's admirable freedom fighting against the racist Jews. It's this evil impulse against the existence of a Jewish nation, against a Jewish independent state, that propels the truly delusional Israeli apartheid weeks, when there is no apartheid in Israel now in fashion in some colleges and universities. Israeli nationalism was judged by the UN in 1975 as uniquely racist when compared to all the other over 100 states that, like Israel, after World War II came into being. Zionism was unique, for its nationalist movement was judged to be, quote, a form of racism. And so last week, the enlightened professionals in the entertainment business here likewise support the idea of destroying Israel. I don't think for a second that they really want to see mass violence, but they do believe that superior to Jewish nationalism is international multiculturalism. So calling for the destruction of Israel is not wholly unacceptable. It is even an enlightened idea. Jewish nationalism is inherently exclusionary in their minds, but Palestinian nationalism is not. The war against the Jewish nation, destined to become a kingdom of priests, will continue until Moshiach arrives.
Ba שיחות והודעות לשמך הגדול הגדול והקדוש על שחייתנו וקיימתנו כן תחיינו ותקיימנו ותאסוף גלויותינו לחצרות קודשך לשמור חוקיך ולעשות רצונך ולעובדך בלבב שלם לשמך הגדול הגדול והקדוש על שחייתנו וקיימתנו כן תחיינו ותקיימנו ותאסוף גלויותינו לחצרות קודשך לשמור חוקיך ולעשות רצונך ולעובדך בלבב שלם
Last item, check out the current piece by the great Andrew McCarthy on the National Review website entitled, quote, Obama's conflict tanked, the Clinton email investigation as predicted, close quote. McCarthy predicted last February, and opined again this time, that the reason the Clinton email investigation has gone nowhere is that proving her guilt necessarily incriminates one of her correspondents in her illicit emails, namely Barack Hussein Obama, who we now know also avoided scrutiny by using an alias on an unsecure system. They both belong in prison. It's also now believed that the reason for the attack in Benghazi was that Hillary's email had been hacked, and the terrorists knew of Ambassador Stevens' itinerary. Namely, Hillary is complicit in that attack and the death of those four patriotic American contract security guards. This woman and this president are corrupt beyond words. He is truly, I believe, an MBA, meaning not a Master of Business Administration, but a Muslim Brotherhood agent. And I believe as well, so is Huma Abedin, Hillary's gal Friday. I don't believe Hillary is. I think she's just so over her head that she never had any sense of being a stooge for Obama's and Aberdeen's anti-American beliefs and behaviors. I hope to see Trump in the next debate reduce her to tears for her unsuitability as commander-in-chief, for her lying, for her influence peddling, her destruction of records, and so on and so forth. Judge Andrew Napolitano's latest post has a list of about a dozen of her felonies. What a story. Anyway, this has been the last webcast of 5776. May you all have a good and sweet new year. I'll be back next Thursday, God willing. Shabbat shalom, and shana tova me'eretz Yisrael.